Good morning. Good morning. Come right in. How you doing? Good to see you. Good morning. Good to see you. Good to see you. How are you? Thank you. Good morning. Good to see everybody. All bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and ready to go, right? There was a boy that was orphaned at 6 years old, and he bounced around from foster home to foster home, and he finally got up to age of 11 and ran away and joined the Merchant Marine. And he worked, just started at the very bottom and worked his way up until finally, when he was in his 20s, he became captain of a slave ship that came from Africa over to England. And he was a tough old bird. His crew just hated him because he really worked them hard. They hated him so bad that one night in a drunken stupor, he fell overboard. And the crew actually debated on whether or not to save him. But pretty quick they decided, well, we got to save him. So instead of throwing him a life jacket or something, they took a harpoon. And they harpooned him in the leg and drug him back up on the ship. In fact, he walked with a limp the rest of his life because of that harpoon wound. But while he was in the water, he met Jesus Christ, and he came back and left the slave ship business and joined John Wilberforce in England and joined the ministry. And between him and the ministry and John Wilberforce, they were the two that were instrumental in getting the slavery abolished in England. And after meeting Jesus in the water, he comes, they pull him back up on the ship, and just a short time after, he wrote the words that we just sang. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound, that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. John Newton wrote those words that we just sang, by the way, for the benefit of the other class. We just got singing that one. Yeah. It's February again. I love February. February is my favorite month of the year because we get to pay tribute to our girls on the 14th, and I get to come visit my two favorite classes on the three Sundays of February, right? So it's great to be here with you. I always bring something to kind of wake you up a little bit. This doesn't apply to everybody here, but it will. This is As We Grow Older is the name of it. But one of these days it may apply to you. The title of it is actually, As I Get Older, I Realize. Okay? As I get older, I realize. Don't wear headphones while vacuuming. I just finished vacuuming the whole house, realized the vacuum wasn't plugged in. During labor, the pain is so great that a woman can almost imagine what a man feels like when he has a bad cold. The girls would say, boo. As I get older, I realize I talk to myself because there are times I need expert advice. I don't need anger management. I need people to stop ticking me off. My people skills are just fine. It's my tolerance for idiots that I need to work on. Oh, as I get older, I realize the biggest lie I tell myself is, oh, I don't need to write that down. I'll remember it. Familiar? I see a lot of head nods on that one. I have days when my life is just one tent away from a circus. Even duct tape can't fix stupid, but it sure does muffle the sound. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could put our, getting lucky, quote, getting lucky, now means walking into a room and remembering why I'm there. When I was a child, I thought nap time was punishment. Now it feels like a mini vacation. Aging sure has slowed me down, but it hadn't shut me up. I thought growing old would take longer. That's a good one. And here's my favorite. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could put ourselves in the dryer for 10 minutes, come out wrinkle-free and three sizes smaller? Oh, I'll leave this up here if anybody wants it. Oh, like to wake up a little bit. Well, we have 3 weeks together, and I call this connectivity because, you know, so many of us don't connect up the Old Testament and the New Testament. And so connectivity is all about the relationship between the two. You know, if we all got together and decided to form a book club, and we're going to meet up here at the church every Sunday afternoon, and the first book we decide we're going to read is Gone with the Wind. So we're going to start where Atlanta was burning and they were fleeing Atlanta. And you say, well, wait a minute, you've missed the best part. You've missed all of the basic character development. You've missed all the plot development that gets you up to burning of Atlanta, right? Well, people who think, well, we're under the new covenant, so I'm just going to read the New Testament. Well, you miss all the good parts. You miss all the character development. And you miss the plots that are forming underneath the current there. And you miss all the prophetic words of the Old Testament prophets. And you miss all the history of the nation of Israel. Because that's what it's about. It's about the history of the nation of Israel. Why is that important? Characters, plot development, same reasons. And so connectivity is about all of these connections that come back and forth that we shouldn't ignore because it enhances our study of the Bible. And you know me, that's what I'm all about, getting you in the book. God wants us in two places, remember? On our knees and in the book. He wants us to talk to Him, to build a relationship, and He wants us in the book so we can learn about Him and His character and what He wants and what He doesn't want and all those kind of things. So that's why I call this connectivity. Now, back when I was in the bank, we'd have a board meeting and or a committee meeting, and a lot of times somebody would kind of get off on a tangent, and you know, we'd have to rein them in and bring them back to the subject matter. And we call this, somebody doing that, we call them, well, they run off on a tangent, or the old Texas expression for that, well, he's chasing rabbits again. Ever wonder where that came from? Well, when hunters would go out in the field in Texas, they could see the rabbit trails through the grass. You can actually see where the grass is matted down. And this trail runs off, you know, into the weeds somewhere. And now if you follow it, sometimes it just stops. And other times it'll wind around, and sometimes it even winds all the way back around and you hit the main trail again. That's what rabbit trails do. And so I call this connectivity, rabbit trails of the Bible. We just want to, I want us for the next 3 weeks to just chase some rabbits, to just run all around the Old Testament and the New Testament, wherever you want to go, and we'll follow the short trails, because there are some that just dead end. We'll follow the medium length trails, and we'll follow some that'll wind clear back around and come back into the main storyline. So that's what we'll do, and we'll kind of keep track of these up here So if we take one that goes here and then one that comes off the side and then this one goes here and another one comes off the side and this one may wind all the way back around and come back in, we'll just follow them as we go around. And each week we'll start another rabbit trail several times. But the main thing is to connect up the Old Testament and the New Testament with these rabbit trails. So how do we go about this? Well, we'll just start somewhere because the connectivity of the Old and New Testament is everywhere. And so with a little background of the Old and the New together, you'll see where the connectivity comes in. So who wants to start us off? Your favorite book of the Bible, New Testament or Old, favorite character, favorite story. Who wants to start us? Yes? Abraham. Abraham in the Old Testament is a great starting place for the lineage that we get of Christ. You say, wait a minute, Abraham is way back there. Yeah, Abraham's way back there and Christ is way up here. And they completely connect from their bloodline because Jesus is the promised Messiah and it comes from Abraham. But Abraham, he was in Syria. Assyria, actually, it was called. He started out with his family in Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia means, meso means in between, and potamium means potami, the rivers, between the rivers. So what two rivers? And that area in between was very fertile, land that farmers could work real well, and so it was called the land between the rivers, Mesopotamia. That's where we get our word hippopotamus. That's the horse of the river. Hippopotami, the horse of the river. So Abraham was in Assyria, not Israel. He was way over left. If you're looking at a map, left and up, Fertile Crescent. And God called him, said, Abe, I want you to do something for me. First, I'm going to change your name. God does this several times in the scriptures. His name was actually Abram, and God changed it to Abraham. And he was married to Sarai, and he changed her name to Sarah. Yeah. And he said, I want to change your name. I want to change your location. I want you to go up and over the Fertile Crescent, come down the coast, and end up in a land that I'm going to give to you. And it starts the Abrahamic Covenant, it's called. God said, you follow me and do what I tell you to do, and I'll bless you. I'll bless your kids. I'll bless your kids' kids. I'll bless you, your entire family forever. I'll make them so numerous that they'll be like the stars in the heavens. You can't count them. It'll be like the sand on the seashore. You can't count the grains of sand. And all of your descendants will be blessed by me, and there'll be that many in number. And not only will I bless your descendants, but I'll curse anybody that curses you. If somebody's against you, they're against me. So Abraham says, okay, I'm on board. He gathered up his advantage miles and packed his suitcases and jumped on a greyhound, and he and Sarai headed out. He took his father with him and some family members, and they went up across the Fertile Crescent and got up north, and the father-in-law got sick. They stayed there for about 18 months. He dies, and they continue the journey and ultimately get to the Holy Lands. And so Abraham becomes the father. He's described the father of the Jewish nation. But that's way, way back, and we're talking about the very first sections of Genesis. Genesis means the beginnings, and that's what it is. And so we see from Abraham, we could trace his lineage from Abraham and his son and his son and his son and his son. We'll get to Noah, and the flood will come, and all those people coming and going in and out, and the sons and of Noah, the three sons of Noah. One son established the dark skin race. One son established the olive skin race, Jewish, and the other son established the white skin race in the world as they populated the world after the flood. So we've got Ham, Japheth, and Shem. And those three then go out and populate the earth. As we watch the line from Abraham to who's his son? Isaac, right? And he was going to sacrifice Isaac. We see these four gleams of Christ's death on the cross. He's going to sacrifice Isaac, and he draws the knife, and he's going to sacrifice him on the altar. The angel stops his hand, and God blesses him, and Isaac lives. And instead of Isaac being sacrificed, they look over, and there's a ram with his horns caught in the limbs of a tree. And so they grab the lamb or the ram, and they sacrifice it, which begins the animal sacrifice. That substitutional sacrifice, the ram instead of Isaac, Jesus instead of us. So the connectivity between the old and the new even shows up as early as Abraham. So we have Abraham and Isaac. Isaac has who? Jacob. Yep. Jacob and Isaac has Jacob and Esau. And you know, Esau sold his birthright to Jacob for a bowl of lentil soup. You remember that story. And Jacob gets the blessing, and Esau was supposed to get the blessing from his dad, and instead it was Jacob. Jacob kind of stole it from him. And so his mom was afraid that Isaac was going to kill him, or that his brother was going to kill him. And so he had Jacob flee to the north to visit Uncle Haran. And he goes up there, and the uncle has these daughters. And Jacob falls in love with one and contracts with the uncle to work for 7 years and get her hand in marriage. That was the dowry, him working for him 7 years. So 7 years goes by. You remember the story. He tricks him, puts the other daughter in the tent in the dark. He doesn't know. They consummate the marriage. He wakes up the next morning. Wrong girl. But then people had numerous wives, and so he contracted again with his uncle for another 7 years' work to get the real, or get the woman he preferred. The first one was rather homely. Her name was Leah. And the second one that he really wanted was, what was her name? Rebecca, yeah. And Leah immediately started shucking out kids. And her sister didn't. And back then, that was the worth of a woman in that culture. I mean, the more kids you had, the better you were. And her sister couldn't have any, and she got all upset about that. And in the meantime, Leah's already kicked out four boys. And so she says, well, look, Jacob, you just take my Egyptian handmaid, this young cute thing over here, you just take her into the tent and have kids with her as my proxy. They did that, and that was fine in the culture then. And so Jacob, you know, being the obedient husband, said, well, okay, honey, whatever you want. So he takes Bilhah, and she starts shucking out kids, boys. And, well, Leah was kind of falling behind then, or it looked like she was going to fall behind, because Bilhah popped out two kids pretty quick. And Leah had only had four at the time and had been trying for a fifth, but couldn't seem to, to get that done. And so Bilhah kicked out two. So Leah said, well, take my Egyptian handmaid, Zilpah was her name. And so Jacob said, okay, honey, and took her, and she started kicking out kids, all boys, and she had two. And so Leah starts having kids again. She has two boys and a girl. Dinah was her name. But she had Leah ends up having all boys and that one girl, Rebekah two boys, Zilpah two, and Bilhah two, which makes up the 12 boys, right? The 12 tribes of Israel. That's where they come from. Dinah, women have no place in culture at the time, so she doesn't count. She's just there. So she doesn't get a tribe. She's a girl, and she doesn't have the right to have property or people follow them in the tribe or anything like that. Which begins an interesting pattern. 12 boys and one girl. Begins an interesting pattern in the Bible. As you read through, keep this in mind. As you read through the Bible, this is kind of fun. 12 and 1. It pops up everywhere. The pattern of 12 and 1. It just pops up all over the place. Give you an example. We're talking about connectivity. Let's jump over to the New Testament. How many disciples? You sure? 12 and 1. Judas went out, died, was replaced by Mattathias in Acts 2. 12 and 1. Now you say, no, that's not right because Judas went out, so it went from 12 to 11, and then we just got back to 12. Okay, fine. Continue on with 12 and 1. Who's the one? Paul. Paul is known as the 13th disciple. Anointed on the road to Damascus in Acts 9. Remember when God takes a two before and knocks him off the donkey and blinds him? Yeah. So that 12 and 1 pattern repeats itself over and over and over in the Old Testament and the New. So next time you read across something with 12 in it, look for the one. It'll always be there. It's kind of a neat thing. So so we have by the way, I don't want to forget it. That's one of these sidelines, Acts 9. I want to come back to that. That'll remind me. We've got then the 12 boys that make up the 12 tribes, and Judah is Leah's fifth son. And Judah was given the nod by God to carry the messianic line. You hear of Judah, the line of Judah? Jesus is the line of Judah. That's where that name comes from. Judah established the messianic line in his tribe. So God said, look for the Messiah. It's going to be in the tribe of Judah because that's who I'm passing the messianic line to. Of the 12, Judah got the nod. So we have the 12 boys then, establishing the 12 tribes. We have Judah carrying the messianic line. So we can look at his line, and it follows down until we get to the big guy. Psalms 23. King David. Yeah. So King David, direct descendant from Judah, comes down from his line, and we have then the establishment of King David. Now, King David has a son, and he dies right after childbirth. Remember the story with Bathsheba? And that son, born in murder, born in adultery, dies. But then David and Bathsheba go on to have another son. What's his name? Solomon. He will be the third and final king of Israel. First one was who? Saul. Second one, David. Third, Solomon. Now you say, Don, I remember in 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles, there's all these kings. Yeah, but that wasn't the United Nation of Israel. The way that happened is we've got Israel. It's a long rabbit trail, isn't it, off Abraham, right? We got Israel, looks like this. That's the water, not birds. This is the Mediterranean. Israel sitting here, and Jerusalem about right there. This is, Israel is 150 miles high and 75 miles wide. It's not a big country. It's not big at all. In fact, if you're looking at, if you transpose a Texas map over it, we're talking about Denton to Hillsboro. That's how big it is. And so all of this took place right there in that little small country. And so what happened is David had Solomon, passed the kingship to Solomon. Solomon was going to pass the kingship to his son Rehoboam, but his son Rehoboam was a spoiled brat, and nobody wanted to follow him, but they were stuck with him as king. But two of the tribes said, you know, he is so spoiled rotten, we're just not going to deal with him. We are not going to go under his kingship. The two tribes were Judah and Benjamin. But Benjamin was a little bitty tribe. Judah was a big tribe. So they said, we're going to secede. And they drew the Mason-Dixon line right across there, just right almost at Jerusalem. And the north retained the name of Israel under Rehoboam, and the south changed their name to Judah, the name of the tribe down here. And so we have a split kingdom. We have two nations, really. And all of the kings that you see in 1 Kings and 2 Kings, all of those kings are in either this one or this one. There's no unifying king anymore. There's only the three. So there's the kings of Israel and there's the kings of Judah. Unfortunately, the kings of Israel were, virtually all of them were corrupt. Can you imagine corruption in government? And the more corrupt they got, the more ticked off God got. And he kept sending these prophets to try to wake them up, to try to make them realize you've lost your first love. Oh, connectivity. You've lost your first love, which is the theme of the book of Ephesians. You've lost your first love. It's what he warned in Revelation chapter 2 about the Ephesian church. He warned them that you've forgotten what you were in this for. We can be that way too in our Christian walk. We can forget what this is for. It's not winning all the chili cook-offs, and it's not how many people we visit in the hospital. It's not how many people we feed at Thanksgiving or the poor on the street. I mean, those are all wonderful things, but that is not why we got into this, right? And that was happening here. So these prophets, I hate this designation because it's real misleading, but I'm going to go ahead and use it anyway. How many prophets do we have? Well, people usually say 4 and 12, which is correct. 4 major prophets and 12 minor prophets. I hate that designation because the only reason that we segregate them from major to minor, the only reason is the length of the book. If it was over a scroll, they're a major prophet. If it's less than a scroll, they're a minor prophet. And people look at that and say, well, I'm going to study the major prophets because they're major guys. These are head swinging. These guys are something. I got to read them. Those minors, I'm not going to pay. The minor prophets have just as important a message as the majors do. It's just that they said it quicker. So they're smaller books. Okay. So all these prophets start popping up in both Judah and Israel, warning them. Did Israel listen? No. They just went on their own way. They did their own thing, and finally, and this is what I'm concerned about our world today. This is my concern for my grandchildren that are 9 and 6. God just said, okay, I'm done. He said it with Israel, the northern kingdom. You're just so corrupt. You don't self-regulate anymore. You let all of these sins preponderate in your government, in your families, in society. You have no regard for me at all. You've just totally forgotten me. So I'm going to take you to the woodshed. At that time, Assyria was the world power. Assyrians were cruel people. I mean, really, they made Hitler look like a kindergarten teacher. They invented tortures and imprisoning people that has never seen, the world has never seen before or after a level of cruelty like the Assyrians had. And the Assyrians came down from the north and swept down and took over Israel. Bloodbath. It was a bad, bad deal. The prophet said, this is what's going to happen. This is what you need to change. They didn't change. God did what he promised he'd do if they didn't change. So away they went into captivity. The Assyrians would normally kill all the men after horrible tortures. They'd take the women, sell them into sex slavery, and the kids they put out in the field and in the caves to work mines and crops. And that's what happened to Israel. A lot of those are 10 tribes, and a lot of them, we still to this day don't know where they are. They were dispersed so across the world that some we don't know where they ended up. Well, Judah looks at this. The people of Judah looks at this and says, maybe there's a message here. And they would have a good king every now and then. Is that me? Is that me? Just ignore it. So they would have a good king or two that would bring the people back to God, that would remind them of their heritage, that would remind them of their faith in the Father. And people would start following them again. And then, sure enough, that king would die or get assassinated. And then some rotten lying cheat would come in and take the throne and take them right back into idolatry. And 4 or 5 of those would go along, kings would go along. And then finally, one would come up. Josiah, for instance, was one. He'd come up and he'd say, God, show me how to get our nation back to you. And he would do that during his reign. Sometimes the reign would last four years. A couple of them lasted 25 years. But after all was said and done, there was so many bad ones and so few good ones, God just said, okay, I'm done. It took 156 years for God to decide that on Judah. Now, it was a blessing in a way that Judah held on and came back to God and backslid and came back, because this 156-year delay, in that period of time, the Assyrians were world power. Well, during that period of time, Babylonia came and had fights and wars and took over the world powership by defeating Assyria. And the Assyrians were no more. The Assyrians, because of what they did to God's fallen nation, God just wiped them off the earth. Nobody knows where they are. The Babylonians came in and completely annihilated the Assyrians. So now Babylonia is world power. And so the Babylonians come in and they have a little different way of doing things. What they would do, they'd come in and they'd take over a nation like they did Judah, and they would take all the movers and shakers. They'd take the mayor and the school board president and the city officials and the constables and the people that could stir up trouble and get people to lead them or get people to follow them. They would take those people and ship them off to Babylon and put them to work as slaves in Babylon. So they're not there to cause trouble. The rest of them, they allowed to stay and work their farms and work the mines and the crops and so on and send the produce back to Babylon, but let them retain their lives. No horrible torture, So all of a sudden we got Judah and Benjamin taken into captivity by the Babylonians. And we got some stories there that you're familiar with. There was a lion in one of them. What was that? Yeah, Daniel. Daniel was a prophet, major prophet, because his book's long. Got thrown in the lion's den, remember? Because he refused to eat the king's meat. He was over in Babylon. He refused to eat the king's meat, and they threw him in the lion's den. And an angel came and joined him that night and held the mouths of the lions closed all night long. Come in the next day, and the king was really impressed. Nobody'd ever pulled that off before. So he let him out, and he made him not a boss, but a superintendent of some of his governmental affairs. He had three friends that did the same thing, refused to eat the king's meat. What happened to them? Yeah, thrown in a furnace. What were their names? Shadrach, Meshach, and I remember that by my shack, your shack, and a bungalow. Not to get them confused with Hart, Schaffner, and Marx. But here's an interesting thing that you probably missed. You know that they went into the furnace? There were three of them in there. How many did they see? Four. Christ was walking around there inside with them and protecting them, putting his shield of protection around them. So did they burn up? No. The furnace got so hot it burned some of the people on the outside of it, but it didn't hurt them. And here's what a lot of people miss. It says when they let them out, how many came out of the furnace? Three. Three went in. Three came out. And it says the furnace was so hot it even burned up people around them, but it didn't touch them. And here's the neat part. They didn't even smell like smoke. Isn't that a neat observation for the writer to make? They didn't even smell like smoke. You'd think they'd come out smelling like barbecue at least. But didn't even smell like smoke when they came out of that furnace. What a miracle, right? So, yeah, and then the king is at a meal one time and in a drunken party, and all of a sudden, this is Daniel 5, all of a sudden some writing appears on the wall. Remember that story? And nobody could decipher it. And they called Daniel in because he's this man of God. In all of these heathens, he's the man of God. So that's who they call. And he calls him in and he says, what does that mean, Daniel? When we today are in a situation where the outcome is inevitable, no matter what happens, no matter who shows up, no matter how much time it takes, it's going to happen. What do we say? Well, handwriting's on the wall. That's where that comes from. Daniel 5, Daniel walked up and looked and he said, Belshazzar, you have been weighed in the balances by God and you've been found wanting. You're going to lose your kingdom this very night. and Cyrus, the king of the Persians, swept in that night, took over Babylon, killed all the soldiers and the people at the party, and ended up Persia becoming now the world empire. So it was Assyria, was Babylon, now it's Persia. And did all that, it's all in the book of Daniel, and did all that off those predictions. Astounding, astounding predictions in the book of Daniel. It's really a cool book. The most quoted book of Revelation is the book of Daniel. There's some timing prophecies in there that he gives the timing through Daniel 9 gives the timing of Christ's birth. Now, we're talking about 800 years B.C. and he gives the timing of Christ's birth. Really, really cool book. Read Daniel 9 and you'll look. It's in weeks. They measured things in weeks. We measure them in days or months or year. They measure them in weeks, but just, you know, 7 days in a week. Multiply. And so Judah goes into captivity and Israel is no more. And they're in captivity in Babylon, and Babylon gets taken over by Persia. And years later, what happens? A little girl is seen, a little Jewish girl in captivity, is seen by King Artaxerxes. He immediately falls in love with her, marries her. She still has no rights. She can't even enter the king's presence unless he requests her. And Esther takes the aggressive stance, walks into the king's presence, and talks him in through a series of some luncheons, meals that she cooks for him, always way to a man's heart, cooks some meals for him, and talks him into allowing her people, Jews, to return to the Holy Lands. You read about it in Nehemiah and the story of his return, and Ezra, the story of his return. Those two minor prophets tell the story of them coming, being released from captivity by Esther and coming back and reestablishing the homeland. So that's how we get back to Egypt. Now, we're under Persian rule, right? Yeah, we're under Persian rule, but years and years and years goes by, and they have this, we're all one now. And they have this civil war. Israelites decide we're going to try to buck the system here and gain our independence. And so they do. They declare their independence, just like we did 200 and some odd years ago, and started fighting for it. And they couldn't get along. The Jews just couldn't get along. And they couldn't decide who was going to lead them and what their ultimate mode of operation was going to be and what kind of government they wanted to set up. They just couldn't get along. And they fought back and forth. Finally, it came down to two factions of the Jews. One wanted to go one way, one wanted to go the other. One we could call Democrats, and the other we could call Republicans if we wanted to learn a lesson from history. And they were so divided that nobody would participate with the other. They were so divided that it became an obstructionist government. They were so divided that one of the groups went to a little small upstart country that had a huge navy. And they said, well, let's go and make peace treaty with them and get them to help us and we'll defeat the Republicans. So they did. They went to this little upstart country that had its capital city in Rome. And they went to the emperor and said, we need your help. We want you to come down and do this and this and this and this. What he didn't know was the head of the RNC, leader of the other party, had just been there and was still waiting out in the waiting room, had been talking to the emperor about getting help from them, and the emperor said, well, here's two factions that can't get along, they're fighting everything, there's a weakness in the country, we can just walk in and take it over. So he thumbed his nose at the Republicans and the Democrats, marched his armies into the Holy Lands, and took it over. And we're under Roman domination, Roman taxation. And Jesus is born in the Roman Empire. That's how we got into Rome. Speaking of Roman taxation, that's another little trail. We talk about taxes and tax rates. Joseph, blue-collar worker, right? The tax rate in the Holy Lands at the time of Jesus' birth was between, depending on what deductions you took on that, depending on which software program you used. With TurboTax, your tax rate was between 78 and 81%. That's why they were so poor. That's why they couldn't do anything. And Jesus was born in that kind of environment. Now, we did genealogies, and we got down to David. How did we get to Jesus? Checking my time here. I got another hour and a half. So we go King David. King David then has a son, Solomon. Well, has a son that dies, and then he has Solomon, right? And if you take the book of Matthew, Matthew traces the lineage from Solomon all the way down the line, generation after generation, name after name after name after name, and comes down to Joseph, the earthly father of Christ. That'd be the legal bloodline down to Joseph. Luke, however, he's a Gentile. He's the only Gentile writer of the Bible. The Greeks held women in a higher society level than the Jews did. And so he did the lineage on Mary's side. So we've still got King David, and we've got Solomon, and we've got all these generations down to get to Joseph. Well, David had a second son, or third, actually, if you count the one that died. There was Solomon, but right after Solomon was born Nathan. And Nathan, you follow Nathan's line, 37 generations down, you get to Mattatha, 7 more generations down, and you get to Hiel, who was the father of Mary. So Matthew gives us the legal bloodline. Luke gives us the maternal bloodline of Christ. And we've got Joseph and Mary getting together and going to Bethlehem. Long answer to a short question. One of the things that happened in between there was Alexander the Great. And I held that one out to tell the story of Alexander the Great. 33-year-old, marches across Europe, conquers the entire world from the Persian Empire. Now everything's under Greek control, and at 33, when he gets over and makes his last battle, finally finishes conquering all the Persians, and now the whole world is under the domination of Alexander the Great, who is a Greek, he kicks the bucket. He didn't even get home. He died at 33. When he finished conquering the world, he dies. We had 4 generals. So the 4 generals says, well, you know, we've been with him all this time, we worked all this time, and here's the world at our fingertips, but there's 4 of us, so what do we do? Well, they decided to just divide the world in 4 pieces. And one took this piece, one took that piece, one took that piece, one took that piece, and this is where the cross happened to hit, right on the Holy Lands, contested areas and so on. That didn't help either. So Ptolemy, one of the generals, and Seleucid was the other general, split those two areas, and they fought for centuries. But the way Alexander the Great won the world, conquered the world, was one of his military tactics was he would get all of his generals in the tent, and he'd lay out his battle plan on a map. Once they came into the tent, he'd hand them, they'd tear off long strips of white linen, and they'd hand each general a piece of white linen when they came in the tent. And he would lay out the battle plan, and once he laid out the battle plan, they'd all leave to do their assignments. You know, one would attack from the north, one from the east, one from the south, one on horses, one on infantry. And they'd get the battle plan down, then they'd all leave the tent. When they left the tent, they'd take their little strip of white linen and they'd dip it down in a bowl of eucalyptus sap and they'd put it and tie it on their arm. Because they didn't have Bulova watches back then, they wanted to time the attacks. They wanted all the armies and everything to hit at the same time. They did that because the blue eucalyptus sap on white linen would turn blue in exactly 30 minutes. And so they could time their attack. They called it Alexander's old time rag band. And my time is up. Thanks so much for having me.